I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. Hey, gang, so you know our show here is sponsored by the wonderful 750, which is a search and find pricing database for wholesale buyers in New York and New Jersey, which we love very much. But we found a few other people who love it, too, one of whom is the fabulous Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, who's here today.
Hey guys, so I buy for a lot of different random wines, and I love to use 750 because there's a lot of great smaller wholesalers on there that you can take a look at. And as Garth Algar would say from Wayne's World, live in the now, use 750 because it's great. And it's wonderful for those liquor buyers and wine buyers out there.
Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, a user of the 750 service. Thank you. Gernot Coleman of Emick Batterieberg in the Mosel on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Oh, hello. Yeah, I'm fine.
Nice to have you here.
Yeah, thank you.
So you were originally working in hospitals.
No, not directly. My first idea was to study medicine.
Oh, okay.
And so I started also to work in hospitals, but then I turned the right way in the wine business.
And it kind of started more as a hobby?
Yeah, it was first it was a hobby, and then it's rising and rising, and so no time was left for other things. And so in the beginning of the 90s, 91, 92, I started with an internship at Dr. Losen Winery.
What was that like?
Yeah, it was a very good time there. Knowing many new people there around. It was a little bit, in this time, at the beginning of the 90s, was a little bit a hot spot of the Mosel Valley. Of course, there was a very good development of the Losen Winery with low yields and very concentrated, more concentrated wine than most of the other producer. And yeah, it was interesting place to be there at this time.
And then you did some other work, stages at other wineries, and you ended up at Van Volksum for about four vintages?
Yeah, I built Van Volksum up together with Roman from between 2000, and I was there from the first day, so the first January of 2000, up to the July of 2004.
And that must have been a little bit more of a boutique operation, a little smaller scale than Dr. Losen in terms of the winery size.
When I was at Dr. Losen, it was very small.
Is that true?
Yeah, it was only... I think it was only 9.5 hectares.
Oh, okay.
And nothing like Dr. L stuff or something like this.
Hadn't happened yet.
Yeah, it was a boutique winery at this time, and
And so, what was that first experience like with Roman? He was an heir to a brewing fortune, and he decided to reinvest in a historical winery that had been neglected in more recent times. Kind of similar to what you ended up doing later. How did those four vintages go along? What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was very really interesting to work together because we were able to do new things. We are doing this also a little bit more concentrated dry and off dry style in these years, and have a really really wild style Saar Rieslings, and I like to work there.
So you kind of moved away from the Prodigate system around that time at Van Volksum, starting to do more things under QBA. Were you influenced by other producers like maybe Hayman Loenstein, or how did that thought process come about?
Yeah, it was definitely also influenced by Hermann Löwenstein and a few others, and it started that movement to show more the dry and off dry stuff, and going a little bit back in the history to the time before the mid of the 60s, where more of the Mosel wines are dry and off dry style.
So a lot of times we think of a Cabernet as a Spätlese and Alsace as being the historical style, but you might suggest that it was actually more of a dry style, and then the off dry styles kind of developed as filtration systems got better you know, about 50 years ago or so.
Yeah, and filtration system is one point, and the other point is also fashion. What was the development? And then from the mid of the 60s on, there was a big time of sweet wines. And I'm definitely not against these sweet style wines at the Mosel, definitely not. But I think it was also very important for the development of the region to show that that is possible to have really great dry and off dry style wines there.
Did that development more recently sort of track with the timeline of global warming in the vineyards? I mean, when I think of Saar, I usually think of wines that are off-dry because the wines can be quite sharp because it's colder there than the Middle Mosel, for instance. But you made very successful wines at Van Boxham, which was in the Saar, not in the off-dry style, wines that I actually liked a lot. But it coincided with vintages like 2003, which was extraordinarily warm. Was that part of it or no?
Okay, 2003 was really outstanding, and you had in every 10 years, every 20 years, you have these outstanding warm vintages. Like maybe the one before was 59 or something like this, and you had it every time. So you cannot have a look on the global warming by a few vintages. There is definitely a change. That is definitely like this. But there is also, I think, the change in the vineyard work, and also change with the yields. And so bringing down the yields, working more, a little bit more on concentration, that was also very, very important for the development of the dry wines. And anyway, as you can see, as if you have a look on other wine regions like in Bordeaux, the more concentrated style now, if you like it or not, it's a mix of climate change and working in the vineyards, and sometimes also technology. So.
And were you and Roman kind of on the same page about the kind of wines that you wanted to make from the beginning? Was it always set out to be that way? Because, you know, one of the more famous estates is Egon Müller, and he made them more in the Saar close by, and he made the more off-dry style. So did you guys know from the beginning that you wanted to make dry wines?
Yeah, that was the idea from the beginning. Anyway, the situation of the Mosel was not so good in the 2000s and end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, and it was very, very hard to sell higher priced Mosel wines on the German market.
I see.
And the German market in the high quality level was definitely in this time, and is also now, was a dry market. And that was one of the main problems. So all these famous estates we have on the Mosel are really, really on the export market. Me too, also here, but it is for us. It was also important to change the view on the Mosel and the Saar for the German market too.
So domestically, the demand was for dry wines.
Yeah, in the higher quality level. So if you have a look on the German markets, there is a big market of sweet wines, but that is a low price market. And high quality sweet wines is only a very, very small market in Germany. And so the big market for high quality wines is a dry market.
So after you worked the 2003 vintage with Roman, you struck out on your own to do vineyard consulting, and you worked with Knebel?
Yeah, I worked with Knebel and several other smaller producers, and also some international projects. And yeah, but Knebel was definitely the most important thing to do, and was very interesting experiments because it was so. It is so. If you have a view from New York to this, is everything is Mosel, but it is so different from the Saar Valley with these terraces, and it is much, much warmer. We have definitely higher alcohol levels and totally other structure of wines, and I learned very much there also in this time.
And then did that kind of track into what you're doing now, because you're working with Terrace Vineyards now, Did that experience sort of help you out?
Yeah, definitely it helps me. And the Enkirch vineyards we have now, we are sitting in the heart of the Middle Mosel, you can say. It's really halfway between Trier and Koblenz now, but the vineyards of Enkirch, from the style, also from the juice style, it's I think it's more, it's closer to the Saar Valley than to the Terrace Mosel.
I see.
Stuff. So the vineyards holding the acidity very, very fine, and that's what I also like. So the acidity is very, very, very stable in the Enkirch vineyards.
So let's talk a little bit about the estate that you're at now, Emek Bad Rieberg, if I'm saying it correctly, which is a very historical estate associated with the monastery going back to medieval times, and then was sold to the family in about the 1495 era, something like that?
Yeah, it's one of the oldest private wineries there. It was it belongs up to 911. It belongs to a Carolingian family and was then sold to a monastery. So 911 was the first document of the winery. And the family of Image, which gives the winery the name, making wine from 1425 up to 1989. And and then they had no children, and then they give it to another buyer, and he's going bankrupt in 2007 with the winery, but also with a real estate business. And
So the Emek family didn't have any heirs. They ended up selling it in 89. Someone took over and then did some more modernization in terms of the winery.
They changed it a little bit, more stainless steel tank, more the selected yeast style, cold fermentation, and also not bad wines, definitely, in this time, but more the modern Mosel style from this area. And for me it's interesting to see now, because we have the old bottles in the cellar, that the wines from this area tasting now older than the wines from the Image area before. So with these more conservative style before, with a longer barrel fermenting and barrel aging style as they had before.
I had an 85 recently, and it was quite good. So I can testify that they do the old regime.
Very good. Age. We have anyway, Enkirch is well known for well aging wines, and we have wines up to 1921 in the cellar now, which showing very well. And that's also for me to run around the great wines of the world. You have to show the possibility to age, and that wines can develop very, very stable, very, very good over a long time. So if not, it can be also nice, but has nothing to do with the great stuff.
And one of the things that seems to lend into your hand in terms of making those kind of great wines is the fact that the vine material is quite old. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the different vineyards and the vine material that you have.
Yeah, it's we are working with four different vineyards at Enkirch. So it is Enkircher Bad Rieberg. So it's the vineyard we are named after, and it belongs to former owner Karl August Emich, who bombed some rocks away between 1841 and 1845.
He dynamited the rocks.
Yeah, dynamite was not founded in this time, but it was a black powder. I have no idea really, but we name it bombing cylinders, bombing batteries, and it was not so uncommon at the Mosel, so he was not the only one who did this, but they started to make a little bit of story around, maybe because it was a monopole vineyard then, and so that was a second name. So the Bad Rieberg is the youngest vineyard in the winery, But now we have also from the Battery Back Bottling, the wines are minimum 80 years old and 100% ungrafted stuff.
Because you take the younger vines and you put them into a different bottling.
Yeah, but we have only at the foot of the of this vineyard we have. We have a few younger wines, and they are going to the CAY, named after Carl August Immich. So that is going to the basic wine, then because the grapes are getting a little bit bigger there, and I do not want to have it in the first wine. Yeah, yeah. The next vineyard is 150 meters to the right side. It's Enkircher Eller Group, short look back to the battery bag. It is a gray slate soil and with a big amount of quartzites. And as you can see, vineyard is also a cultural process. It's you have bigger stones in it because it is so young. And now we are coming to the vineyard with the Eller Group, which is which we know it's planted. Minimum from the beginning of the 11th century, and there we are more in the blue slate soil and have much smaller pieces of stone, and that is often the most elegant wine in the range of the winery.
Do you think when does that elegance start to show? I mean, is that from bottling, or does it take a while in bottle too? Because you've been making wines there since 2009, and I guess I'm frequently drawn to the Batterieberg. I wonder if that's just because the Batterieberg is a little bit more impressive in youth, or I'm just dumb. It could be the other reason.
Yeah, you know all the vintages in the moment, or
I've had 9, 10, 11.
Yeah, 9, 10, 11. Okay. For me, it's this in the Eller Group. There is a special kind of clearness and a little bit another structure of acidity in every year. Acidity is a little bit higher than in the Batterieberg, and that's for me the sign for the elegance. And also another structure of minerality, not so aggressive. Uh-huh. The Batterieberg is a little bit more masculine, aggressive minerality, and the Eller Group is a little bit softer. In the style.
And you make a couple other, because the Batterieberg is a monopool of a larger vineyard, and then you make a bottling from that vineyard as well. Is that true?
The Batterieberg is a monopole surrounded by the Zepfvineyard.
Got it.
Yeah, and
it's very difficult for me.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, so that is Enkircher Zepfvineyard then. It's when we step back from the Eller Group, we have to go 100 meters back to the left side, and on the directly at the border to our Batterieberg, we have 8 terraces of very old wines. That's the smallest vineyard we have, and it's very expressive and very deep wines of this stepping up part.
So these are terraces that you really can't work with machine or even with horse. Old school terraces, and actually there has been no phylloxera in this area too. Is that correct?
Yes, it would not be good for the horses to work on it. No, they would fall down, and it's really steep. So the main parts of all these vineyards we have, which we bottle as a single vineyard wines, are minimum 60% steepness, and mainly in the middle part, or around 100% steepness. And so everything is done by hand. We do not have a tractor for driving in the vineyard, the winery. So also for basic wine, also we do not have flat vineyards in the winery.
And when the grapes get to the cellar, you mentioned that the previous ownership had done a little bit more modern stainless steel style. What do you do with the grapes when they go to the cellar?
Yeah, so we are picking in small buckets, and then The first decision is how long skin contact will be, and it depends a little bit on the wine, where these grapes are going to, and also to the vintage. I can say for the CAY, it's between 3 and 12 hours skin contact, and for the for the single vineyard wines, for the cruise, it's between maybe 12 and 18 hours often. So that is a general word, but I decided in every harvest day new and what is with the grapes and what's the situation
And then you age in Fudra?
After pressing, we have a very short sedimentation, and it's often only 3 hours up to 12 hours. So I let the juice really dirty, so as you can say, and then I make a decision: is this going to stainless steel tank for fermentation, or is it going to a barrel? But we are not using the old style Fuder barrels in the winery. The reason for this is a more practical reason. Because mainly I do the, after we took the winery over, all the barrels we found in the wineries were rotten, and it was and we need a quick solution with new barrels, and I wanted to work definitely with barrels for the cruise. And so Markus Molitor gives us older barriques from him, which he's working with Pinot Blanc before. I think that was a good decision. And anyway, the wines have the structure to hold the smaller barrels, and they are not new. So, for example, in the 11th vintage, the youngest barrel now was 9 years old. So it's not influenced by wood. It's only the micro oxidation a little bit and the structure which would give. But there are totally other wines from the barrel than from the stainless steel.
And what's your approach to the lees? How do you handle that? Like the sedimentation, do you leave it in contact with the juice for an extended period of time?
Yeah, all the bottlings are totally sur lee, so 100% sur lee. It's very seldom that I rack a barrel before, so they are staying on the total yeast for the full time. So filling, bottling for the basic stuff, it's mainly around the 15th of May, and for the bigger wines, it's the end of August, first week of September, they stay in the barrel, they ferment until this time. So then I make a very late sulfuring. Often only a few days before bottling, and also then only one filtration.
And does that mean that if you don't rack that you have a different, or what is your approach to carbon dioxide gas, I guess would be the question I'd have. If you're not racking, do you use the carbonic gas as a protective element on the wine, or how do you?
Yeah, it stays in it. So in the barriques are small barrels, so there is a big amount of going out. But everything which is in it, it's going to the bottle clear.
So it goes into the bottle, and so there might be a little dissolved carbon dioxide gas in the bottle. So it might be a perception of spritz.
Some natural gas is often in it. Yeah. But it belongs also to the vintage a little bit, also the gas is holding in the liquid. So.
And you use wild yeast, like a native yeast. So do you get a bit of a Sponti character sometimes?
Yeah, definitely I get, but it's not so hard in our winery because I'm working a little bit more oxidative, and so you do not have these extreme what this stinky nose, but definitely you can smell it that the wines are spontaneous fermented, and we make it really really strict, so every barrel start by itself, so I never give starting culture from one barrel to another, for example, or something. So every barrel has to start for itself. So, of course, for me, that is the idea of spontaneous fermentation, to have a wide range of structures in the different wines. And so this is all then coming together with the different barrels. So, for example, maybe the battery bag is 12 barrels, for example, and then it's coming together and brings the structure and the complexity I want to have.
And with the finished wines, I mean, how should I be as a consumer? How should I be consuming those wines? What is the suggested time that you would recommend that I age a bottle of the different vineyard sites before I drink it?
It belongs a little bit to the vintage. Maybe we have a short look on the 2011. 2011 is a vintage which is at the most a very very balanced vintage, and it opens up very early, so it was not so complicated, and so it starts showing very well up from November last year, and it's also showing very well in the moment. But I'm sure it will close in a short time, because that's the normal way the wines are going. And for example, the 2009s are pretty close at the moment and need much air to come back. 2010 is running also well. You can taste them better. But that is not only a style of our winery. That's also a Mosel type. So you have these fresh fruit phase and a clear, more fruity phase, and then the wines are going a little bit down, and you think, oh, it's getting a little bit boring, and this paper taste a little bit, and then coming back, and mainly the worst years of. For high-class Mosel wine, it's between 3 and 7 years old.
I see.
Yeah. Mm.
And what has the reception been like in the market for your wines? I mean, how have they been received? There's been some, through no really relation to you, but there's been some changes in importation in the U.S. market. I wonder, from your point of view, how have you seen the wines received in Germany and globally?
Yeah, I think we had a really, really good start, and landed in a bunch of very high class wine shops all over the world, and showing with the best wines of the world, people were curious about the wines and talking about it, and so we were very successful with the beginning of the winery. And and it was a good start here. We start here with the at the U.S. market with Mosel wine merchant, thanks to Lars Karlberg and Dan Malia. And this business stopped, and then we started directly with Louis Dresner Selection, and I think it's definitely a high class place to be for the U.S. market.
And how have your peers received your wines within Germany? Have they caused any kind of a fluster, or are you recognized in the... Because there are several magazines, and German wine press seems pretty vibrant. What has been the reaction?
I think in Germany, but that's not very seldom. In Germany, it was okay, I can say, but it's the international view was a little bit better, definitely better than the German market. But it has also to do how the German press market is a little bit arranged, you can say.
And it seems you share that characteristics that I see in a lot of great winemakers, which is that you seem to know, bless you, exactly what you're about. At the same time, you're willing to have experiments for your own knowledge. Like, you're curious, but at the same time, you have a very clear idea of what you want to do. I mean, I guess my question is, how did you get there? Because it wasn't necessarily, I mean, you did say that the dry wines are popular in the German market, and we have seen other people like Keller achieve a lot of fame with dry wines. But I mean, how did you decide that this was really your thing? And I should say, you also have made Auslese before and such, but I mean, how did you really know that that's what you wanted to do in Einkirk?
I think I really do what I like to taste. So,
yeah. Okay.
So what I like to, what I like to drink for me, great wines are elegant, structured wines with a high enough natural acidity, which is very important for me, because so many acidities now coming out of a great sack, and that is what I'm looking for, and also these extreme poor slate soil vineyards are able to bring these out, and that's what I wanted to show. And as I just told, it's what I like to drink too, and what I'm searching for.
And you do have contracts with other areas for some of the blended bottlings that you make at the lower end. Are those contacts that you made during the time that you were consulting as a vineyard consultant, or how did that come about? And what do you see those adding to the blend?
Yeah, it's. I think these are contacts from my whole time at the Mosel. So I started at the Mosel in 91 and then going away for studying, but then starting again at the beginning of 97. So I have great contacts there. And I was searching for the entry level, also for very fine, good acidity holding soils, and often not the hottest soils, more often high class side valleys like the Oberemmeler Altenberg, where is a hectare of ungrafted wines coming from, and also the Drohner Hofberg, which is now well known because Andreas Adams,
sure,
who's making a really great job for me, one of the best wine producer now at the Mosel Valley, and I'm proud to have also all the grapes from these great places, and it's for the consumer. The situation is very good because they are going to the basic wine now, and that has also a little bit to do with the situation at the Mosel, because many of the producers are selling their wines to the open market, to the salary market, and do not get good prices, which they can live from the big salary. So for them, it's attractive to work with us, getting a little bit better prices, and we have really great stuff to work with.
And you do, for IMIC, you mostly, it's all Riesling, right? You don't make
98% Riesling, and there is one small hobby vineyard, Pinot Noir.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
It's not on the US market. So if you come to the Mosel, you can taste it.
And
three barriques a year. So,
you do make Chardonnay from Rinka. So I guess what I would ask you is, what is it like? What is distinctive about Riesling? Like, from your perspective, I mean, obviously a lot of people might have their own ideas, but, you know, this is a great variety that you work with from different sites. What do you think Riesling really brings to the table that maybe Chardonnay doesn't, or vice versa?
I'm not so in these grape variety stuff. I'm interested in places where wine is coming from, and I think there are grape varieties running on a place and others not, and on another place the opposite. And and so the decision with this Rinke vineyard directly at the Luxembourg border, which is a very poor, nearly white, chalky Cameridian soil, and that was definitely also from the climate situation there, that was definitely the place for Chardonnay, and to keep it Alejandre anyway, it's not 100% Chardonnay. This wine is only one. It's a one wine winery, and the wine is made in the Immich cellar, and. But it's good 90% Chardonnay, and there are a few wines of Viognier, a few wines of Pinot Blanc, a few wines of Tramina, few wines of Pinot Noir going in it too. And as I say, it's for me the place. The place shows the wine, and you have to find the right grape variety for it. So, and also, with the, it's now starting a little bit of Riesling hype, and I see that many people plant Riesling, for example, and I see it from Australia, I see it from California, and it tastes many things, and I'm off. I'm not. I think it's not very interesting to taste it, and so people are working often with the grape varieties like a brand, because people are able to learn it very quickly. So they learn the word Chardonnay, they learn the word Riesling, they learn the word Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot, and then they knew what they have to buy. But that is not my view on winemaking and great vineyards. Mm.
And let me ask you, where it seems that you're of a generation that has drunk broadly from global sources, and where are other parts that your heart has led you in terms of wines that you enjoy from other parts of the world, whether they be white or red or any color?
Yeah, I can definitely say the main. The main other influence out of the Mosel is coming from Burgundy, and that's a big hobby for me. I'm often there, friends there, and I like to be there, and also like these focus on these nice, very small plots and many different wines, and that's really interesting and. Amazing stuff, and also you find there what I said also to the white wines. You find elegant, focused, and structured wines, and that's what I'm searching for. And sometimes also with not at its acidity, and nowadays it's getting more and more. But there are many left. And I like this very much. But also the Northern Rhone. Some Loire producers. You see, I'm a little bit more on the north side sitting, more in the natural acidity side. Yeah.
And let me ask you. I mean, your estate is fairly small. It's 5 hectares of vines, just about 11-12 acres of planted vines. You have to work it all by hand. No machinery, no horses. It's terraced. There's cover crops. I mean, the wines don't sell for a ton of money, maybe because they're not super well known. I mean, they sell for a good amount, but not like, oh my God, prices. Mm-hmm. Is that an economic proposition? I mean, does that make sense? Does that work out at the end of the day? Or is it something that you're really going to need other people to hear more about the wine so that the prices can go up at some point to make it work? I mean, it just seems like that's a lot of manual labor with not a lot of volume, and at the same time, the prices aren't that high. So how does that work out? Or are you just fabulously wealthy? if I may ask.
No. We are definitely not. No. The situation is I think the main problem is that the yields are so extremely low. And for example, we have after these very small 2010 vintage, now the 2012 vintage, also with lower than 25 hectoliters per hectare. And in the average over the years, we have around 35 hectoliters per hectare over the whole winery. Yeah, we have to grow. That's definitely important for the future. The development is good, but we have to develop further. Yeah.
And how do you like the wines to be drunk? In terms of, if I weren't eating German food like you would find there, if I weren't having sausages, what works well with the wines that you make?
Oh, that's not so easy because they are so different from vintage to vintage. And
a lot of times people hear like, oh, off-dry Riesling with Chinese food. Yeah, that's a very common thing. But your wines aren't off-dry, so where do I?
Yeah, sometimes they are off-dry, but I often do not like it really, because sometimes for me the spicy with a little bit sugar, I'm not so. I'm not so in it. So, for me, my wines are going more with the fish and chicken side, but also without food anyway. I would say more this classical food. Not too. You can drink it also with extremely spicy stuff, but now that then the taste is close and it's not so combination seems not so good for me. Because one main point for me also with the wine making and wine growing is to have really balanced wines. I do not want to go in these expressive extremes and that's maybe against also these more extreme spicy stuff to eat with. You know?
And what do you see as the future of the winery? I mean, you've achieved a lot at a fairly young age. You had a great run of vintages at Van Volkslum that were winery defining, I think, for that winery. You did some consulting work. You made some outstanding bottles for people like Knable. You purchased a winery that dates back to medieval times and has incredible vine material. All of this seems to have happened in fairly short order from your deciding, hey, you know, I'm not so into working in the hospital. What is next for a guy who seems to move along at a fairly brisk pace?
We have now 2008 Riesling Brut Zero running, and this is a cuvée as it is from the time before Emich Batterieberg. It's 50% of it's coming from the Knebel Winery, from a Winninger Hamm.
Oh, okay.
And 50% is coming where I also get now grapes from the Oberemmeler Altenberg, so from the Saar Valley. So it's the two opposite sides, you can say, of the Mosel region. So the Oberemmeler Altenberg brings more the lightness in it, and the Winninger Hamm a little bit the density. Yeah, and 2008 was a great vintage for sparkling wines because it holds the acidity very, very nice. Also in the in Winningen at the Terrace Mosel. And was 3 years on the yeast, and it's now available, and it's absolutely Brut Zero.
No sugar added.
Nothing added, and also. And also non-sulfured stuff, and experiment with it, and people like it very much. It's a little bit out of the normal fruity German sparkling side. It's very has a very fine sparkling, and it's it's really deep and spicy. Yeah, I like it. I like it very much. But the next vintages we will have will come from the upper part of the Enkircher Eller group mainly. And yeah, cause the last we were really alone in this part of the Eller group. So it's a very high vintage. It's a very high vineyard. And the last, you can say the last 80, 90 meters up to the forest line, it's totally surrounded by bushes and forests. And we will leave all the grapes every year. So we decided to pick it really early and start the sparkling from this side. So it is extremely fine soil, and I think it will be great after this.
I look forward to drinking a bottle.
Yeah, thank you.
And you've been around a lot of wines. What is your favorite drinking story?
I think the best situation, the best drinking situation for me was at a small Normandy beach with the cliffs, very, very high, chalky cliffs, sitting with a high class champagne bottle and having some oysters at this beach side and waiting for the sun going up and I think that was one of the best moments drinking a bottle of champagne. Yeah.
Gernot Coleman, thank you so much for being here today. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, gang. So you know our show here is sponsored by the wonderful 750, which is a search and find pricing database for wholesale buyers in New York and New Jersey, which we love very much. But we found a few other people who love it, too, one of whom is the fabulous Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, who's here today.
Hey, guys. So I buy for a lot of different random wines, and I love to use 750 because there's a lot of great smaller wholesalers on there that you can take a look at. And as Garth Algar would say from Wayne's World, live in the now. Use 750 because it's great. And it's wonderful for those liquor buyers and wine buyers out there.
Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, a user of the 750 service. Thank you. All Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online. AllDrinkToThatPod.com, no apostrophe, AllDrinkToThatPod.com, or on Twitter at DrinkToThatPod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.